Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest running podcast, now in our 19th year. I'm your host, Jess Marquez, and our guest today is Rick Arpin, Managing Director of KPMG's Las Vegas office, to talk about the wild ride that was 2023, the early projections for 2024, and the current state of the sports betting market. Today's GGB podcast is sponsored by Pavilion Payments, which empowers gaming institutions to create an enhanced patron experience with a complete suite of integrated payment solutions that enable safe, secure, and trusted cash access at the cage, on the casino floor, or online. Learn more at pavilionpayments.com. In today's world, gaming is big business, and that inevitably means that KPMG is not far behind. As managing director of the firm's Las Vegas office, Rick Arpin is one of the leading experts and consultants in the industry, and this is certainly an exciting time to get a sense of where we've been and where we could be headed. Arpin and I spoke via Zoom in December. Rick, thank you so much for joining us this morning. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing great, Jess. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. And it's such an interesting time to have you come on and talk with us because, you know, I, for one, have only been in the business for a short amount of time compared to you and others. But it's interesting because as we sit here, it is late December and we're about to wrap up. Arguably, you know, Las Vegas has been around for many, many years and have many successful years and many records broken. But here we are probably at the end of what I and most people would consider to be the most successful slash influential slash impactful year in the city's history for a lot of reasons. But I kind of wanted to just get your general take. I mean, as somebody, like I said, who's been around for a long time, seen a lot of things, as you reflect on this year, kind of what are some of the things that stand out and, you know, what's your take on this, on 2023?
Yeah, I mean, I would generally agree with the Jets. I mean, I think what's amazing about the gaming industry generally, and I suppose Las Vegas in particular, is that, you know, we do exactly what you just said. And then what do we do next? Well, Super Bowl's coming, right? We on to the next thing, right? We have succeeded as a city, and in many ways succeeded as an industry in our ability to keep pushing forward and keep reinventing and looking for the next things that our customers want to experience and have in their product portfolio and so on. So I think that's the spirit of the industry. I think this year was really successful, and I think in particular, you look at the things that we were sort of running into. I mean, we had a pretty successful year, maybe a wildly successful year in 2022, sort of continuing the rebound from COVID and this all the notions of pent up demand and everything else that people were saying, hey, look how strong gaming is, and a lot of folks said, well, that can't continue. We'll hit a plateau, and we really didn't. And then you think of the other sort of headwinds, high interest rates, inflation, some other things that are going on in the macro world, geopolitical, you name it. And yet still such a successful year, sort of industry-wide and again, online and land-based, certainly Las Vegas being a big part of that. So I think it's really impressive, the performance that the industry put in.
Definitely. And, you know, I'm curious from your perspective, if we look just here locally at Las Vegas, you know, there were so many, from a business perspective, there were so many, you know, new venues that came online, both, you know, some new casinos, some new entertainment venues, so many new expansion projects. You know, you have grounds, it feels like every week, you know, I see all the things come across my desk. It's like ground broken is like the phrase of the year. And even obviously, you know, looking ahead to next year, there's things that are going in down the pipeline. But as far as all the things that happened this past year, what were some of the developments, and they can be big or small, you know, obviously depending on what you view to be particularly interesting, but what were some of the big kind of highlights and some of the big developments that you look back on as being particularly impactful?
Well, I think, I don't know if there's any one. I think that in general, I would say one thing that impresses me is you're right about the sort of use of the word groundbreaking, and seeing development happen. Whether it's Fountain Blue sort of finishing its project finally, so to speak, or new development that's starting, the confidence in the market is pretty impressive. Again, considering that these are capital assets that in many cases are funded, at least in medium to large part with debt, that folks are paying much more for than they were 2-3 years ago. And yet, they're willing to invest that capital. That's how confident folks are in this industry. near term, as well as obviously midterm and long term. And so I think structurally, that's all very, very good for our industry to see that kind of interest and investment in the industry. You look at, you know, to pick one, you look at station casinos. Obviously, their projects individually are not that large relative to some others, but you know, several hundred million dollars is still several hundred million dollars. And they not only, you know, put in Durango, but I think there's already talk of expanding that property even before it opened. And they're already looking at their next, they put in plans for the Inspirada, and they've got sort of a roadmap of years and years of development ahead of them for this valley. And again, just, you know, the family, the ownership, the executives of that company, they know this market very well, and they're saying something to us, right? They're saying this market is worth investing in. So I think that's pretty notable. Just that sort of confidence in this market is pretty notable.
I would agree. And, you know, kind of building off what you said, I thought it was interesting to see how basically every, I don't know what you would want to call it, pillars, I guess, you know, you have like projects that cater to, you know, the really high end luxury like Fountain Blue. You have like the locals kind of in between with Durango. You have sports, obviously, all those things. So I thought it was really interesting to see how it wasn't just one avenue. You know, you really had stuff brewing at every different level. I thought that was interesting. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I would say I think these things sort of snowball on themselves, right? I remember conversations we used to have when I was at MGM Resorts quite a while ago, before we, you know, before we had T-Mobile Arena, before we had Allegiant Stadium and so on. You know, the city had just developed, you know, way back when, the Smith Center. And we said, you know, what else does this city need to be sort of a world-class city? You know, we think of ourselves pretty highly. Others may think of us highly or not. We sometimes feel like others underrate us with a little bit of, you know, that sort of mentality, underdog mentality. And we said, what else do we need, right? World-class sports facilities, you know, we can check that box. We're probably getting more of those, so that's great. You know, we've talked about medical, and we've been, you know, the city and the valley have been working on that, and UNLV Medical School and other things. And you know, I think a museum's coming at some point, right? You sort of check off these boxes, and all those things sort of feed on themselves, because now everyone else is sort of looking at the market going, oh, well, if they can have these sports facilities, well, they can have these other amenities. And so I think it's just tremendous momentum for the city, especially, you know, obviously we took a hit with the financial crisis, and we took a hit with the pandemic, right? Like a lot of people did. And the city has just sort of, you know, kept its feet moving through those issues, and it's got a lot of momentum.
So as we look ahead, and I know that this is obviously, you know, projections and forecasting is a huge part of, you know, your job, and any person who is in that, you know, side of things, it's always, you're always looking ahead. People are always asking you what you think. I think the interesting thing about, you know, the transition from this year to next year is like, and again, this is just my perception from reading everything and kind of everything secondhand. I mean, but it's almost as if people are kind of reluctantly optimistic, is kind of like what I would term it as. It's like people acknowledge that there's been such great success, and the numbers, the revenues, obviously Nevada, I don't know what we're at now. I think it's like 32, I think, months of a billion plus in a statewide win. But then, you know, there's obviously, you know, macroeconomic conditions. There's still, you know, I consume a lot of general business press. I still see, you know, how much kind of a fuss people are making, and it seems kind of strange how there's almost like this disconnect of like, yes, we think that the success is going to continue, but we don't want to go full bullish, but we're still kind of, we can't deny what the numbers are telling us. It's like a weird dance almost. And again, I'm not, I'm as somebody who is not nearly qualified enough to speak on it, but I'm just, you know, going off of what I see. But would you agree with that? Would you agree that it's kind of uncertain even for the people who are high level experts at this?
I think that's right. I mean, part of the problem you have is that when you have, in our case, 2 or 3 years of a bit of abnormal growth, particularly, again, I'll say like on the land-based side, we sort of took this big dip during COVID. We sort of had this rebound. You know, this industry is much more, on an organic basis, is sort of a plug along 3% a year type growth industry. What's caused dramatic growth in our industry has been big expansion of gaming, et cetera, et cetera. There's an event-based sort of growth. And so that the last few years though, and in the land-based side has just been extraordinary sort of organic growth. The online is where we've seen the event-based, you know, add-ons. And so the markets, analysts, investors, others, you know, what they love to do is say, oh, good, you grew 6%. That's what it's going to be like forever, right? It's not going to be that 3% it used to be, right? That's what they'd love to think, because then that helps the investment thesis, right? Well, operators are smarter than that. And so they are, you know, they are tempering expectations in a way, both their own internally as well as externally, because you can't just grow at 6% organically forever or whatever the numbers are. You have to settle back into sort of some historical range. And then it's up to the operators to focus internally and say, okay, can I make 3%, 4%? Can I make more profit at 3% than I made at 3% growth in the past, right? Can I have a better margin? And that's the things that we see folks focused on for the maybe the coming 12 months is really that sort of environment, especially in Las Vegas. It's not just a Las Vegas issue, but it's highlighted in the news with Las Vegas because we just signed a new labor contract that sort of baked in cost increases that have been happening and will continue to happen anyway, but we just put them on paper, right? That we are going to give these people, you know, healthy raises to match sort of cost of living here with inflation and whatnot. And that's going to weigh on that margin aspect. And so operators are going to be working very hard to try to mitigate costs in other areas and that sort of thing to help make sure they can maintain their profit growth, even assuming, which I think they're mostly assuming, that we do come back to a more normal growth rate in the coming year, or in fact, you know, maybe in this year, you know, retrench a little bit. Maybe we only grow 1.5% compared to historical, because we did grow so much in the last few years. We've seen that, you know, in the regional markets, we're seeing some states with decreases year over year in some months, right? And totally, to me, very expected. I mean, I sort of predicted that for this year, which again, I mentioned earlier, sort of surprising how well we performed this year. So I think it has to happen eventually. It's probably happening now and into 2024. And so operators are just preparing themselves and they're frankly, again, tempering expectations externally a little bit.
Well, that's interesting. And it reminds me of what you said reminds me of a comment that I heard at G2E from Michael Lawton from the Gaming Control Board. And he said that, you know, they were talking about obviously the record results recently. And he said that, I believe if I remember right, that their internal projections were that the second half of 2023 would be when they returned to pre-COVID averages. Obviously, that's not what happened at all. And the growth, you know, far surpassed that. So I think that is of that as well. One thing that I've heard echoed, you know, by analysts and other economic heads is that gaming in particular, if you look at the whole economic landscape, that gaming in particular may be potentially more well suited for a downturn because of all of the lessons that were learned in COVID in terms of, you know, margins and things like this and, you know, getting debt under control. Would you agree kind of with that overall sentiment that the lessons learned from COVID could perhaps, you know, lessen the impacts that that we would feel from an overall economic downturn or soft landing or whatever the term du jour is? You know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think we always sort of had this notion that we were recession resistant or recession proof, some people would say, and we disproved that in 2007, 8, 9, 10. And I think we learned a lesson from that to not be so confident about that. And I think when you add those lessons with, to your point, some of the lessons or practices we were able to put in place during COVID, and frankly, just where the industry is at, the sort of more omni-channel place that the industry is at, I think the answer is we are probably better positioned for the next economic wave. But the real questions will be, there'll be a couple. One, what does the economic sort of cycle look like? Is it a recession? Is it a soft landing? Is it something we haven't thought of? You know, operators will have to be nimble. I think a lot of folks will have to be nimble because one thing I think we've again learned this year is it's hard to predict. I mean, I think just about every economist 12 months ago or 15 months ago was thinking, well, we have to have a recession. And then it hasn't happened. And now they're saying, oh yeah, no, we're going to have a soft landing. So why do we believe them now when they weren't right last time, right? This is what, you know, economists can do the best they can. They have their models and we have to work on scenarios, right? So there's other scenarios that could happen that we will suffer more in, and there are other scenarios where we'll suffer less in. relatively speaking, though, we should be in a better position. I think the other factors are as you said, the industry is better, is a little better capitalized today than it's been, you know, probably in many years. And again, it's a little more diversified, which always helps in these times. And so I think those are some of the things. And then yeah, you layer on just the ability to be more to react quicker to things. We should be better positioned, but you know, it's really hard to predict, and we should be thinking about different scenarios because we don't know what's going to happen.
So that's interesting. So I guess to kind of put a bow on this topic, speaking in terms of like, let's say projecting to this exact point next year. So I guess like, let's say in a hypothetical situation, we're sitting here again exactly a year from now having the same conversation. Would you be, how surprised would you, I guess, let me see how I want to word this. Would you be surprised if we are still sitting here next year talking about great success and records and momentum and all the things, or would you be more in line with a kind of a more like what you were saying, more like kind of regression to the mean, kind of more like this was good, steady? Would you be surprised, I guess I'm saying, if we are back next year with the same kind of conversation topics, or would you expect more of a mainline type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd be more surprised 12 months from now than I am today about the last 12 months. Right? Like, I you know, if you had to peg a number on just GGR across, you know, states of the U.S., and I'll use land-based because it's the more same store, you know, sort of notion, I would have been lower than what actually happened. And so I continue to think that it has to sort of come back to a bit of the mean here. I think the real questions from my perspective really get into what companies do in their own situations, which is where, you know, as a firm, that's where we, you know, try to help our clients as best we can when they're in specific situations. So if a company's, you know, a regionally based company and they're feeling that a little bit more than the Vegas based companies, what do they need to do from a cost management perspective? Do they need to be looking more for some inorganic events to be happening? Do they need to shift strategies a little bit? You know, if you're Vegas based, but you're still thinking about what to do around sports betting, you know, where does that go? And is that part of your strategy or isn't it? Again, you got in such individual circumstances. I mean, Fountain Blue can be focused on one thing, right? Which is just stabilizing their operation. Like every property that opens, you know, the first 6-12 months is just sort of getting to a normal state of operation, right? So everyone's got their own story within this sort of macro that I think the macro is going to be somewhat boring, frankly, but it's going to be those individual stories, you know, and we might be sitting here next year talking about some blockbuster M&A that, well, we didn't see that coming, right? Or something else that happened that we just didn't see coming. And I think that's what we're trying to not predict, because again, you can't predict that, but sort of be ready for is what are those scenarios that in a somewhat bland macro environment, what else should we be looking at to drive activity for these companies?
Interesting. That's interesting. And I guess I guess, you know, you in such scenarios, you would always rather be too low than too high, right? Because you can always bump it up and you can't bump it down, right?
That's generally speaking. I mean, there are, you know, there are trends you can certainly miss, but I think I don't see any of those happening this year. I mean, I think everyone, you know, if you think about sports betting, I think we know where companies are trying to go. They're trying to go to customer retention, product portfolio, you know, really honing in on the user experience in their tech stack, right? That these are evolutions, not revolutions for maybe the next little bit, whether that's 12 months or 6 months or 18 months or 24 months, right? Land-based, I think we know where we stand, generally speaking, with our labor and where it's at and our customer and generally where they are, and we'll react to the nuances within that. But, you know, we're not, again, when coming out of COVID, we're like, what are all these 25-year-olds doing in the casino? You know, that sort of thing. We're not seeing a revolution, I think, this year. It's an evolution. And that's where, again, what happens in these timeframes is that the best operators should rise to the top, right? Because there's no sort of artificial noise you can create to generate a story that sort of overcomes not so great operations. Those that manage margins well, those that eke out It's like, you know, every new customer and every little bit of revenue from their existing customers, those are the folks that are going to succeed well in this environment.
Definitely, definitely. And it is, I'm definitely interesting times for sure. As we, you know, all eyes every month, you know, when the latest round of data comes out, it's like, you know, that's like the first thing that I want to see. So I'm sure you're the same. So I want to move to sports betting now, which, you know, you talked about, and probably, you know, here we are, we've been talking about growths and records and all these kind of things. And sports betting is probably arguably like the main driver of that, coming off the year we just had. It's interesting to me, you know, and I'm going to sound ridiculous probably, but like, I just remember when I was a kid growing up in Reno, but sports betting was like this thing that was so out of, it was like, you had to, if you were a sports bettor 20 years ago, like my grandpa was a member at the Silver Legacy in downtown Reno. And we used to go, and he's a big 49ers fan. And we used to go, and he used to like to bet on the 49ers games. And I used to think that was like the weirdest thing. Like, and you know, to think now how far it's come, not just, you know, just around the entire country, but especially this last year, it's just insane. And I can't, you know, I sometimes it's just crazy to me. And this past year, obviously, we had two deals that, I mean, arguably would probably be like the if they were in separate years, they probably would have either been the most important story. You know, I'm thinking of ESPN bet and then Fanatics betting. Both of those deals are just so interesting to me from a thousand different ways. I'm sure you as well. And I kind of wanted to just get your take on those specific deals, you know, those deals in particular, but kind of what they signify for the industry as a whole when you have moves like that, that are just so, I mean, talk about home run, you know, or not home run, but like a swing, you know, just a big bet on something like this. I just haven't seen in a long time. So kind of that's a lot to say, you know, sports betting is in a crazy time, and kind of what did you think of this past year with all the crazy moves?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, you can juxtapose sort of investment into the space, mm-hmm. you know, with the, like the deal, the sort of activity you mentioned, Fanatics building up sports betting operation and doing an acquisition, and then the sort of ESPN and Penn coming together with their deal. And you can juxtapose that against, there's folks that have exited the industry, right? Exited the U.S. sports thing. It's sort of, hey, we tried it. You know, Kindred most recently said, hey, you know what? We're not going to spend more in the U.S. In fact, we're gonna get out. So we're still in a phase. We're so early, you know, 5 years, 6 years seems like a long time, but it's really not in the grand scheme. And we're still early innings of just figuring out how this space will ultimately look like, with a lot of dimensional factors that are hard to predict. iGaming being an example, other investment from outside the industry being an example. You know, we know about some, but we don't. There's probably others we don't know about. there's a lot of factors at play. I think what's important from my perspective is that the investments we've seen are indicating that there is value in sports betting. And then when you combine that with some of the retrenchments, I think what it says is the value in sports betting is maybe not just in the sports betting. And when folks in gaming would tell you, have been trying to tell everyone for a long time, it's a low margin business. You're not going to make a ton of money in sports betting. So where is the value, right? So from an MGM Resorts perspective, and Caesars perspective, the value is in an omni-channel experience for their customers. Penn, you know, Boyd, others, all thinking that's one element at least of a strategy. Others, sports teams, leagues, media companies. Remember when we were all excited about Bally's and Sinclair? You know, oh, that seems so long ago, right? Media companies seeing value, obviously ESPN being an example, and then other companies seeing sports betting can be a conduit to other relationships with customers. So that's sort of the Fanatics story. So those investments, those beliefs are, I think, really, really important, because they're going to be part of the story of how this industry ultimately is positioned and is part of our culture to where you're going. It's sort of ubiquitous. Well, why and how? Those are parts of that story. And again, dimensionally, you know, iGaming throws a bit of a wrench into that, because iGaming you can make money in. And in iGaming, it's much better to be sort of a traditional gaming operator, you know, like an MGM, or, you know, if you're a European, if you like European companies, a Flutter or Entain or someone, you can use your name, pick your name. But that doesn't then jive with the other stories. I mean, ESPN probably doesn't care about that. That's not relative to their core business. Sports is, right? So it's incredibly dynamic area still. It's going to take a while for this all to settle out. If I knew where it would settle out, I might not be sitting here talking to you. I don't really know. But, you know, somewhere in these moves, it will settle at some point into a more a mature industry with a sort of a better position, knowing where sports betting fits in the landscape. I don't think we're there yet. I think there's still going to be more coming in and more leaving and more, you know, shakeups and, you know, there'll be some M&A, I'm pretty convinced, as well. And there's a lot that needs to happen before we get to that point. And if the operator, you can just listen to the operators. I mean, every time, you know, BetMGM, MGM, Caesars, I mean, just about everybody talks about their product. They say, our product's not where we want it to be yet. Right. The user experience isn't where we want it to be yet. I mean, because it's all it's been for 5 years is just get into a new state, find some customers. Right. This industry has a long way to go to get stable. And so we're sort of seeing the sausage get made as, you know, as we go through these times.
So you kind of actually led right into my next question, which was that, you know, this level of activity, I'm kind of, my mind goes more towards the, you know, the potential exits and the potential cannibalization that could happen, just because, you know, I think a lot of us see that, you know, FanDuel and DraftKings are just, I mean, running away with market share. And it's really kind of become a battle for third, essentially, for most of these companies. And that's a tough place to be in when you're devoting this type of resources toward it. So would you expect to see maybe one or two or however many number more of, you know, big time exits and or consolidations in the next 12 months or so?
Yeah, I don't know the timing. Again, it's not only depends on the industry itself, but the macro factors. Like if interest rates were 0% at the Fed level, I'd probably be more confident saying, yeah, of course you're going to see some deals happen. Then when they're, you know, 5%, so borrowing rates are 7-8%, that makes it harder to do a deal. So, we may not know the timing exactly, but I think, yeah, over time that will happen. But I think like all of these things, there will also be other activity taking place at the same time, new entrants, new products. I mean, a year and a half ago, maybe even for some people 6 months ago, they didn't know what DFS pick'em games were, or that there was any controversy around them, or what the heck they were all about anyway, right? And now all of a sudden it's in the news because is it fantasy? Is it not? Is it sports betting? Is it not? And you know, folks are not going to stop innovating, and there's always going to be room for that type of activity, right? I think if you equate it, it's not a perfect analogy, but if you equate it to land-based, you'd say, well, 15 years ago, you said, of course, all the casinos on the strip are going to be owned by Caesars and MGM. That's just what's going to happen. And some people might actually believe that just because they look around and that's what they see. But when you look a little deeper, not true at all, right? There's a lot of single property and sort of dual property, right? You've got Venetian, you got Wynn, you got Treasure Island, you got Circus Circus, you got Fountain Blue now, you got Resorts World. They're not all owned by Caesars and MGM. And because, you know, there's always room for sort of innovation. There's always room for smaller players in, you know, with sort of targeted reasons for being, I hate to use the word niche, but with a specific purpose and a specific audience. And so sports betting will be no different. iGaming will be no different.
Interesting. That's very, very well said. I definitely could understand what you were saying with that, which, you know, is difficult sometimes. But one thing that I really wanted to talk with you about, and I was really curious to get your take on, as somebody who is like really lives this business and into the nuts and bolts of things. I think one of the more interesting kind of storylines for me with sports betting over the last year has been kind of the focus on advertising and bonus spend, which obviously comes from a few different perspectives. Obviously, from a regulator's perspective, you know, there's been a lot of sort of, you know, back and forth of responsible advertising and such. And then obviously from a business analyst perspective, you know, it obviously cuts a lot into the potential profitability of a lot of these companies. Do you think that the combination of these two forces kind of working together, I mean, what do you think that leads to eventually? I know obviously the short answer would be, well, it just leads to, you know, a pullback and, you know, less offers for players and such. But I think overall for the industry, what do you think it kind of leads to? Because I feel like we are kind of headed towards some kind of inflection point on this, because because like I said, you know, between both the regulatory standpoint and the business standpoint, it just feels like something's got to give either way. So kind of what's your take on that part of the business?
Yeah, I think so from an overall perspective, I think it's part of that maturation process that I mentioned earlier. And I think this is part of that. So I think as time goes on, it becomes more stable. I think the operators would, I have been trying to tell the world that that's been happening anyway. A lot of them have these sort of graphs they show that show like, hey, like in New Jersey, we've been around for all these years now. That activity is already, much more stable, right? It spiked and then it's down here now. And so customer acquisition costs, were way above revenue potential at the start. And now they're, we flipped that and, at a macro level, then the operators start talking about, hey, we'll be EBITDA positive, or we already are EBITDA positive. And the reason is because those graphs sort of start overlapping. Like, yes, there's new states where there's promotions and other things spiking, but there's a lot of states now that are very stable and they're much more in customer retention mode. And so that's part of that maturation process. And I think everyone in the industry understands, and I'm speaking specifically around bonuses here, that, eventually, again, when they get their products the way they want them, when they're doing much more customized user experience and a much more in tune with their customers and what they're looking for and develop, the better mousetraps, they don't have to use bonuses as much because they have other tools in their tool belt, right? When you're starting out, that's about the only tool you have. And so they used it as much as they needed, right? From an advertising perspective, it follows a similar trend. You're going to advertise more at launch and that sort of thing, and you're going to sort of calm that down in terms of activity. I think the nature of advertising and the sort of, how much and what certainly will be more driven by regulation than I think the sort of the promotions will be more driven by the business side. But I think, there's an acknowledgement by a lot of people in and around the industry that we need to take care of this and be proactive in this space. So the AGA, you've got these, the sports leagues put out something, others have put out sort of some best practices. Some regulators have taken some actions. I think we'll see that. My personal view is it won't get to the point it's gotten to in other countries where they've just sort of had this, it built up, and then they just sort of, had this massive impact with some, draconian advertising regulation. I think, that it'll get a little more moderately managed, if you will, and a little more jointly managed, a little more collaboratively managed. That doesn't mean there won't be some pain along the way or some, things that happen, but I think it will to some extent self-manage itself, and it will follow that same trend of to a mature state where advertising will just be will feel a little bit more normal, and it'll be regulated at some level. And, we won't have any sort of, I don't believe we'll have sort of a draconian backlash against it. We'll have more of a moderate backlash that we'll react, the industry can react to and sort of help self-regulate.
Interesting. And it's certainly, now to see the play out, how the cat and mouse game of, they ban a certain phrase and they come out with their next phrase. What are they on? Like, no sweat now, I think is what the current iteration is. So I don't know what other, phrase is coming next, but, so this is the last one I had for you. And thanks again for taking your time. I really, really appreciate it. I feel like you can't have a discussion about sports betting, and certainly from a business perspective, without talking about the tax environment. Certainly from my perspective, as I said, as somebody who, sees everything come across my desk every week, it's really fascinating to me to see how, these states are just really just the variation, between markets. I mean, you have New York obviously going 51%, Ohio doubled earlier this year to 20%. That I feel like that was one of the more under reported stories of the year. That was fascinating. You have Tennessee's decision to tax handle, which is very odd and kind of sticks out as well. So from your perspective, how do these differences, kind of factor into your thought process? And is it, as we kind of get more mature and more states come online and we have more data, are there any states or any examples that stand out as being like maybe good to follow in the future? Or you say like, wow, that actually worked out pretty well. I mean, I know Colorado is often cited as a favorable environment. Kind of what's along your thought process?
Yeah, so I'd probably get in trouble within my firm if I gave specific names of states. But what I would say is the again, part of the problem with the pace of the rollout is that the regulatory environment has been a bit scattered. To your point, it's been quite variable. And that's not just taxes, that's other regulations as well. And operators are definitely feeling that. We hear from our clients quite regularly the difficulties they're facing sort of managing through the regulatory environment. And frankly, you know, heard from regulators, the same thing, right? There's folks on regulatory boards who are trying to keep pace and keep up, and it's hard. And so I think what'll happen over time is that we'll get a lot more clarity in general regulatory schemes, if you will, like processes. There's not a lot, there's some states where there's just not a lot of clarity in what folks are supposed to do to be compliant and with the gaming regulations in those states and in terms of sports betting. And so that needs to be improved. And I think it will over time as there's more experience with operations in those states. You know, in the land-based side, you know, it would be like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, folks were looking around, well, is it Nevada, New Jersey were the exemplars because that's all we had. And they sort of built off of that. And it went at such a, even though it seemed fast at the time, land-based expansion, relative to sports betting, it was quite slow. And so regulators had time to sort of think through what do they want to put into their regulations. That's not to say they're all the same. There's still variation, but they had time to be a little more thoughtful about it. The sports betting happened very quickly. And I think the Ohio, you know, up to 20%, now a bill maybe to go back down to 10, I think just shows that the pace is an issue when you're trying to put in thoughtful regulation and thoughtful tax structures, et cetera. So I think it needs to improve from a clarity perspective. And I think it needs to settle in from a stability perspective second. So the Ohio would be an example. Like, it's just not good to have changes every year when operators need to make 3, 5, 10 year strategic decisions. That makes it very hard to operate, you know, and so I think, you know, it makes it hard for a state to attract investment. You know, folks might pull out of that state, but still be in other states, right? That sort of thing. So then the last one I think is the variability that'll work. So I think it's clarity first, stability second, and then, you know, folks maybe getting together and saying, oh, you know what, maybe ours should be a little more like yours. And you know, regulators have done that over time, right? Again, in the land-based world, we've had regulators that they have regular sessions together through different organizations, and they talk about best practices and talk about current issues and trends. And they sort of pattern each other. But, you know, one of the more recent ones is cybersecurity. And what do you need to report to a gaming regulator? What do you have to have in place for gaming regulators? And some states have these regulations, some don't. I think some more will have it over time. And so that will happen, I think, a little more naturally. But but I think it's, again, sort of clarity first, stability second, and then work on maybe a little more commonality among the states.
Definitely, definitely. Well, Rick, thank you so much for joining us today. This is certainly a crazy time to talk with you. But you know, it goes without saying, if it wasn't for the craziness, you know, I wouldn't have things to cover, and you wouldn't have clients to advise. So
that's right.
From that end, tell everyone at the KPMG team from us, happy holidays, and hope to talk with you again, sir.
You as well, Jess. Happy holidays to the team, and keep up the great work. We love what you do for the industry. So thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this GGB podcast, sponsored by Pavilion Payments. Pavilion Payments is the entertainment and gaming industry's biggest vertically integrated payment provider, offering solutions that create a simple, secure, and more effective way for patrons to wager and fund their play. Learn more about the full suite of gaming solutions available at pavilionpayments.com. To learn more about Rick, KPMG, and all the important issues of gaming, subscribe at ggbmagazine.com. To stay current with all the weekly news of the gaming industry, subscribe to ggbnews.com and use the coupon code GGB180 for a free subscription. Don't miss an episode of the GGB podcast by subscribing on Amazon, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts today. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.